Right now, pretty breezy. Wind from the south at 13, gusting to 28. 45 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha under a gray sky. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. The incredible true story you are about to hear unfolded in Russia back in the early 1990s. During that time of incredible upheaval and turbulence in the immediate wake of the dissolution of the Soviet Union. It was at that point in time that folks at the Children's Television Workshop here in America thought that it might be a prime opportunity to create a Russian version of Sesame Street. And somewhat surprisingly, they chose to head up the project someone who had absolutely no experience in children's television. But she was an award-winning television producer and filmmaker named Natasha Lance Rogoff. She has written a fascinating book about the experience of trying to create a Russian Sesame Street. The book is titled Muppets in Moscow: The Unexpected, Crazy, True Story of Making Sesame Street in Russia, published by Roman and Littlefield. I began my interview with Natasha Lance Rogoff by asking her why the book is only appearing now, so many years after these events unfolded.
I started writing the story after the show aired. So Sesame Street Russia aired in 1996, and I had enormous amounts of material that I saved from that time, more than, you know, almost 30 years ago. I had journals and memos, videos that I had made on mini DV tapes, where I interviewed people who were part of this extraordinary experience. And I thought I might make a film about it at some point later. And so I had all these boxes which would move with me as I moved with my family to different cities. My husband's an academic. And so I finally, in 2017 about, I went back to Russia, and this was a period when Putin was really starting to quite a bit more crack down on independent media. And I just, I kept thinking, wow, this was an amazing experience that we had so long ago, and look at where we're heading now. It seemed like there were a lot of lessons in my experience, having worked in Russia on, Sesame Street for 5 years, and then the previous 10 years before that, making documentary films in Russia and working for news. And I was noticing that every Netflix and Amazon show which had Russians in the storyline as characters were, thugs, criminals, prostitutes, oligarchs, and they were real caricatures of the Russian people. And I didn't see the people that I had worked with for so long in Moscow making Sesame Street. I didn't see them reflected in these depictions, and that really bothered me. I also felt that, these are people who made so many sacrifices in the 1990s to try to build a better future. for Russia. And, you know, they were also incredibly disheartened and depressed by, you know, what had happened. And this was even before, you know, Russia invaded Ukraine.
Right.
So I wanted to write this story. I wanted to tell their story.
Hmm. That really helps explain the timing of this, and I appreciate you sharing that. Ahead of us digging into the story, the heart of the matter, I think it would be interesting for our listeners to understand how you found yourself in Russia in the first place. I don't mean in the spring of 1993 when you returned to Russia to begin this work. I mean earlier than that, when you had worked in Russia for some time, more than a decade. Explain to our listeners what first drew you so powerfully to Russian culture and what led you ultimately to want to even live there and work there.
Well, I went there the first time when I was 22 years old as an American foreign exchange student. And at that time, it was the Soviet Union, and we had two programs, one in Moscow and one in Leningrad. And in my program, there were 30 students from all over the United States, from different colleges. And we studied at Leningrad State University. We studied Russian. From the day I went there, I mean, I was already so fascinated with Russian culture in high school, you know, from reading literature, and this, you know, the writing was just so seductive, and this other world, it just seemed like, you know, such a romantic, fascinating place. And also my grandfather, you know, came from Russia. So it was already something that I was really curious about. Although, you know, I come from a big family with five children, five siblings, and my other siblings were not that curious about where they came from. You know, I read tons of literature, and the stories were so so bizarre, you know, like the you know, goggles, the nose, and I just felt somehow drawn to this unusual place that had a completely different economic system and life than our own country, and this was during a time when you know, we were in America, in the West, very concerned about nuclear war. You know, I can't believe we're, you know, having these same discussions again and the same fears, but we are. And, you know, they were the enemy. So I was intrigued. I wanted to see what this other society looked like. And it was a unique opportunity to go there as a student in the 1980s. Hmm. So that's how that all happened.
I know that one of the things that you did during those years was created something of an expose describing gay life behind the Iron Curtain and the kind of challenges and threats that many gay people faced in places like Russia. Did anything in particular draw you to want to tell this particular story?
It was you know, coming from America at that time in the 1980s, when the gay community was just becoming quite a bit more active, more visible, and really having some traction on gaining rights that. You know, are now taken for granted in much of the country in the U.S. You know, this wasn't the case in Russia. And I went there, I was part of the artistic community and, you know, had many friends from the LGBTQ community. They did not call it that at that time in Russia. And many of these people were being blackmailed by the KGB to report on friends, and you know, this was a perfect example of Soviet active measures, you know, within their own society. And the attitude towards homosexuality in Russia was this was written, you know, into their legal document. Homosexuality was against the law. So, you know, many of these people had a very hard life. And I just started writing about that in 1983 and published a piece in the San Francisco Chronicle. So that was the beginning of my you know, trying to do something to help in that country and make people in the West more aware of what was going on there. I mean, we, as I say, people were also fighting in the U.S., so it was a story that had resonance for the LGBT community and others in the U.S. as well.
Hmm. We're speaking with Natasha Lance Rogoff. We're going to be talking now about the heart and soul of her fascinating new book, which is called Muppets in Moscow: The Unexpected Crazy True Story of Making Sesame Street in Russia. Natasha Lance Rogoff served as executive producer for a Russian version of Sesame Street that was created and aired in the 1990s, in those tumultuous years following the fall of the old Soviet regime. Ahead of us talking about your undertaking of this incredible challenge, for which in some respects you were not exactly naturally suited, and we'll talk about that. You are returning to Russia in the spring of 1993 to undertake this task, and you had been away from Russia for a couple of years. Explain what had led to your departure from Russia a couple of years before that, and in a sense, the kind of trepidation you felt in terms of returning to a country which you expected to find, and indeed did find, to be utterly transformed.
Well, I had lived in Russia for I had lived in the Soviet Union, and during the last years of Soviet rule, I spent time making a film. So 2 years, for 2 years, I embedded with anti-Western, pro-communist, many fascists who did not want to see the Soviet Union collapse. And these conservatives, you know, were doing everything they could to maintain power, understandably. I mean, this is a huge country, the Soviet Union. It spans 1/7 the world's surface and includes millions of people, including Ukraine, Armenia, Georgia, you know, all these former Soviet republics that are now independent countries. At that time, I was interviewing people and following a steel worker, a police chief, and an entrepreneur who were all part of this new society, Soviet society, that was just opening up under Gorbachev. And I wanted to describe what their lives were like. And I made a film called Russia for Sale, The Rough Road to Capitalism. And this is, you know, this was part of the opening in the Soviet Union, was towards markets. So the idea was that you would loosen the state control over the command economy, and then people would be able to have what I would think of as limited entrepreneurship. But at this time, it was still generally illegal to sell things independently in the Soviet state. That film I ended up predicting the coup of 1991, and the night of the coup was on ABC News Nightline, because few people had been following the conservatives, and I had, you know, been filming them for several years. So after that film completed, and it aired on PBS television, I came back to the States, and, you know, the Soviet Union had just collapsed, and I was now in my 30s and really wanted to, was starting to think about, you know, having a family, and, okay, I've spent the last, you know, all my 20s in Russia and the Soviet Union, and maybe now it's time to essentially, you know, grow up, become an adult. So I came back to the States, and my family was there. My father, you know, was my mom had died earlier, and so I really wanted to, you know, come back to the U.S. and then I was showing my film around the country, and these two Sesame Street executives showed up at one of my film screenings and asked me if I would consider helping them bring Sesame Street to Russia. And at this point, I thought, you know, my time in Russia was over, that I was going to try to do something else. And, you know, rather than being an independent documentary filmmaker, you know, maybe I'd get a job, like, you know, with a 401k or do something like that, and, you know, have some security, because it's pretty tough, you know, making a living as a filmmaker. And anyway, they were very encouraging, and I, you know, was kind of surprised. I told them I had no experience in children's television, and they, you know, they were pretty persistent, and asked me to come down to their headquarters. Hmm. So that was how that all happened.
I remember, as you talk about this moment, I think you say something to the effect that not only did you have absolutely no experience in children's television, you scarcely had any experience with children. I mean, you had no children, and you know, really had not had much in the way of even, you know, sort of contact with children. So there were a lot of ways in which you were not a natural fit for this challenging assignment. Of course, on the other hand, you brought other kinds of experience that they deemed to be very, very valuable for such an undertaking. One thing I want to be sure to ask you about is that when you talk to these two representatives from the Children's Television Workshop, they offered up slightly contrasting visions of what this program would, in a sense, look like. And in some ways, I suppose, maybe even at the time, that was probably a little disconcerting. And maybe in retrospect, you realize that that was maybe a harbinger of just how difficult this was ultimately going to be. Explain the slightly different vision that these two gentlemen had about what a Russian version of Sesame Street might, in a sense, look like.
The workshop was incredibly ambitious. They had then Senator Biden had spearheaded congressional support for a Russian Sesame Street, but the funding wouldn't be released until we had matching funding from Russian sources, either Russian television or Russian private sponsors. And that was because the U.S. government wanted the new Russian government to have skin in the game. And within the workshop, there was not a consensus on what type of production Ulitsa Sezam, which means Sesame Street in Russian, should be. The difference was one executive wanted the show to be limited production, so more dubbed material from the American show. And the other executive wanted it to be a whole-scale original production with a much smaller amount of dubbed material from the U.S. show. And at the time, like, you, again, you give me more credit than I deserve for having foresight about how difficult this show would be, because, you know, I just listened to them, and, you know, I really didn't have a clear idea of, first of all, I hadn't been in the country for a couple of years. It was a new, independent, a fledgling democratic country with a growing market economy. And at this time, lots of bankers and investors and, you know, people buying up raw materials and evangelists trying to, you know, convert atheists, communists to religious awakening. You know, it was a crazy time in Russia.
and it's like everybody wanted to be there, in a sense. I mean, not literally everybody, but all kinds of people who probably just a few years earlier would not have even thought of traveling to Russia and investing there and so on. And suddenly it just seemed like fertile ground for all kinds of different projects and possibilities, and an American version of Sesame Street just being one of them.
Correct. Exactly. We were the soft power do good for, you know, Sesame Street is a nonprofit, and, you know, we were there trying to change the way children would think about themselves and their opportunities in the future. And, you know, but there were many other, you know, entrepreneurs and bankers and everybody over there that, you know, it was a huge market and they wanted to make money. So this was the environment that I went into. And in hindsight, when I look at, and I talk about this in the book, but, you know, considering the obstacles that we faced in terms of people getting killed, you know, the assassination of our Russian broadcast partner, the car bombing of our first sponsor, and as well as all the cultural clashes that we encountered, it's phenomenal that this actually worked in this environment. So the fact that there were people in the workshop who, from the get-go, had said, maybe this isn't such a you know, good idea, and maybe we should scale back our expectations, I think that I portrayed that accurately in the book. But at the time, at the age I was, you know, and not having any experience, you know, in children's television or with children, I kind of poo-pooed that. You know, I was like, we can do it, you know. Yeah, let's go do it. You know,
right.
This will be great. And let's do, you know, I'll just jump in. And that was, you know, the way I had approached many things in my own personal life, too. You know, I had this theory, this mantra that I would tell myself, which was, you know, if something intimidates me, you have to do it. Like, this was a rule I had. And if my own children had the same rule, I'd be terrified.
So. You know, I wanted to ask you about this, but in a sense, you've, I think, to some extent, answered it. I wanted to ask you why, as somebody who had lived and worked in what then was the Soviet Union, why you, in a sense, didn't have as much concern. I mean, how you went in with, you know, all of this optimism and seemingly not completely, but maybe to some extent, kind of oblivious to all of the pitfalls, all of the challenges that were going to face you. But it seems to me, as you're describing this moment in history, it's almost as though you and others were swept up in just the prevailing spirit of optimism by which that was drawing all kinds of people to Russia at this moment in time. And in that respect, it makes all kinds of sense to have this sense that anything was possible at that moment in Russia.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, what's difficult to think about now in where we are today is it's hard for people to, either they weren't born yet or they don't remember, but this period when communism collapsed, this is after 70 years of the investment of billions and billions of dollars by the West and by Russia in, you know, nuclear weapons and war, and, you know, fighting each other in Afghanistan and all other places, it's really, you know, for territory, I mean, not directly. But this period when the Soviet Union, the Soviet Empire collapsed and you had new countries emerging like Ukraine and Armenia and Georgia, it was you know, just incredible. It was so much hope. There was hope both in Russia and in the United States that a different future would exist, that Russia would join the free world, that the whole global, you know, economy would work together and collaborate. We had people, you know, who were evangelical about capitalism and expecting that, you know, it was going to somehow rise up and grow in Russia overnight. I mean, there was a great deal of naivete, and this was all happening against the backdrop of extreme poverty, violence, you know, within Russia, and fear of the uncertainty of what was to come in their own country, and the, you know, what would happen for their, with their children and their children's lives in the future. So I think it was, you know, this is a narrative that Putin uses over and over again to justify his autocracy. And that's why, you know, another reason when you ask, why did I write this book? The 1990s are really critical to understand if we want to find a way out of this. It is a window into the historical experience that Russians had, you know, that impacted the following years.
Hmm. We're speaking with Natasha Lantz-Rogoff about her new book, Muppets in Moscow, The Unexpected, Crazy True Story of Making Sesame Street in Russia. Of course, the heart and soul of your book is what you were just talking about coming back to Russia at this momentous era in its history, and trying then to launch a Russian version of the beloved children's series Sesame Street. First of all, at this moment in time, we're talking about the year 1993 when you begin this work in earnest in Russia. At that point in time, what did children's television in Russia look like? Was there even such a thing? And if so, did it bear the remotest resemblance to a program like Sesame Street as we saw it here in the United States?
Yeah, it was. There was a program called Spokojnoy Nochi Malashi, and it was a very old program that children would watch before they went to bed. The program itself was extremely low production values and didactic, and encourage the children, you know, to be obedient and then go to bed. There was not a lot of production at the time that we started making Sesame Street in Russia. The studios, film studios, were dark because there was no state funding for film. And before we arrived, television production itself was very far behind the U.S. Television had been used during communism mostly for propaganda, and while aesthetically it was brilliant, you know, in terms of block print and, you know, graphic designs, the production values were very low, and most people did not use computers at all. So everything, computers, you know, were just starting in the U.S., the computer use in corporations, email, for instance. But In Russia, nothing. No use of computers in the television station. So everything was handwritten. In addition to that, the longest dramatic TV series that had ever been done was only 12 episodes.
Wow.
So we were going to be producing 52 half-hour episodes, and that had not been done.
Mm.
It was unprecedented.
Wow.
So when we went to our creative team and, you know, began talking with them about this, their reaction was, it's not possible. And, you know, we found a way, you know, which included giant poster board, you know, on the wall with the list of tasks and all, you know, broken out by music, film production, everything.
Mm.
But before I jump off, I also want to say that the history of film in Russia was extraordinarily artistic and world-renowned. So you had the big studios, Mosfilm, Gorky Film Studios, that had made, you know, some of the most admired films from the 1920s. And we hired those directors who had worked in film but had not worked in television much. And the same was true. We pulled in all kinds of people from different professions, as well as animation. And animation in Russia was phenomenal. I mean, most of it was hand-drawn cell animation and, you know, world-renowned at that point. So the Soviet animators were fantastic. We pulled them in, too. And eventually our team numbered 400 people between the puppeteers, the writers, the animators, the filmmakers, the producers, the set designers. It was quite an amazing, eclectic and diverse group of people on the team.
Some of the difficulties that you faced were very specific to the matter of trying to import a specifically American product like Sesame Street into this Russian market, which is challenging enough. But there are also some things that probably had a whole lot to do with just the way at least many Russians tended to kind of operate and would have made any undertaking probably challenging. I think one of the most amusing is when you were talking with one of your Russian colleagues about how to kind of facilitate things, get things moving, and so on. And their advice to you was basically to not write anything down, to not, you know, make any sort of specific goals or timetables or anything, because first of all, you can't predict anything. But also, they said something to the effect that in order to avoid delays, just don't ever promise anything. That way you'll never know if there are delays or not. In other words, just don't ever set deadlines, don't ever set timetables, and just sort of let the chips fall where they may. And it must have been amazing and maddening to be working at least with some colleagues there where this was their means of operation, which just doesn't work when you're talking about something as complicated as a television series.
No, I would say, you know, the approach to work and was very different, and that was a particularly Russian solution to eliminate any problems. Just don't write it down. No, it was great. I mean, eventually they did. They did work very hard, and they learned how to do production budgets and schedules and everything. And, you know, they were totally converted by the end of the show and working, you know, in a way that was, you know, equal to the way productions are done in the West. And they were really proud of what they learned so quickly. So it was just, you know, in the beginning it was really tough, but then, you know, change anywhere is so difficult.
Of course,
but the bigger issues also were like the you know, not just the way of working, but ideas and, you know, the conversations that we had with some of the Russian educators, because we adopted the Sesame Street model of the creative people, the producers, working with the children's education experts to determine the content of the show. And that was, you know, that was quite a difficult process with, you know, for instance, when we first, we had a 3-day seminar with all the educators who had come from across the former Soviet Union. And this was in the summer of 1995, and it was held at the Danilov Monastery, which is a the headquarters of the Russian Orthodox Church, which dates back to the 13th century. So it was kind of an intimidating environment to be working in, and we had just rented space here. And you know, there was a lot of confusion about how the Russian educators and the Georgians and the Ukrainians, you know, how this post-Soviet education experts would come up with ideas for what the show should teach their children. What do children need to learn in New Russia? And one physicist said, you know, after we had started the discussion for a while, he said, you know, you're tasking us with coming up with what we should teach our children in order to thrive in a new open society. But we don't know what a new open society looks like yet.
Hmm.
And, you know, there were all kinds of poignant discussions like this that, you know, touched on the most basic things, you know, including like showing children running a lemonade stand, you know, which I somewhat stupidly proposed in the course of our debates and discussions as a way of teaching kids counting and team building skills. And this was met with horror by the educators because in communist times, the only people who would sell things on the street were criminals and, you know, the mafia, because independent commerce was illegal. So, you know, that was a pretty innocent, I thought, you know, suggestion. And there were many, many examples of this in the book where you really get to have a deep understanding of Russian culture and the history.
Right. And, of course, you know, we're talking about a couple of different things. And one of them is, you know, to what extent this program should be or could be in what some would regard as kind of an instrument of propaganda and of trumpeting very American ideals and American progressivism. But the other thing is the matter of balancing what you talk about in the book about education versus entertainment, and how one can certainly have strong ideas about certain concepts that are important to teach, but the last thing you wanted to do was to create a program where it was so heavily weighted that direction that it ended up being just terribly dull, something that no one would want to watch. I mean, and just balancing that education versus entertainment, that's nothing unique to Russia or to Sesame Street, but that was also a challenge that you had to wrestle with.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And also, you know, we had 45 writers working on the show. We had a real generation gap between the older writers and the younger writers. And, you know, the older writers, the first head writer we had, who later got fired, only wanted to hire established children's literature authors. And, of course, these authors, while they were extremely talented, could not learn the television writing style that we needed. You know, they were submitting, like, 10-page tomes, and it was very often beautifully written, but quite dark. And, you know, we had a number of writers that would submit scripts, and they were all writing independently of each other. But we found that something like 90% of the scripts were like escapist. They had escapist themes. And, you know, for example, one was about a family that went off to France and ate fine cheeses and foie gras. And, you know, this isn't quite relevant to children or to Russia.
Right.
But, you know, it was only recently that Russians were allowed to travel overseas. And, you know, a few years earlier, otherwise it was almost impossible. So, of course, they were writing about, you know, what excited them. And we understood that. But there were great, you know, differences between the way that the Russian and you know, post-Soviet writers were writing about issues from the American show. Mm. And, you know, one writer said to me, we find this all very difficult because, you know, the American show riffs off of pop culture. You know, you have a shared popular culture, and it's easy to write jokes about it. But here, you know, our recent past is very painful and raw. We can't make jokes yet about Soviet culture that, you know, our society that has just collapsed. Our healthcare system has collapsed. We have great poverty, you know, and we can't make jokes about the future, new Russia, because we don't know what it is yet, and we don't have a shared culture yet. And I just thought, oh, wow, this is so fascinating, and we, you know, we're really going to have to work together to try to figure out how do we write about this? Mm. How do we model new ideas of a gentler, more tolerant society that is still very Russian and culturally sensitive and relevant to Russia? So the show is not an American show. It's a very Russian show.
Right. And your book chronicles all kinds of different details about the making of the show. One of my favorite chapters, because I'm a music person, is titled, Is R for Rachmaninoff or Rock and Roll? In which you are really struggling with the person you hope will be your music director, you know, to help them understand the role that music should play in this program, but what that music needs to be. And, of course, it needs to be more than Rachmaninoff or Rimsky-Korsakov or whatever. And there is another wonderful chapter in which you explore the whole matter of the Muppets, named in the title of the book, and the resistance from at least some of the people on the staff, including someone who at least at the time was your head writer, who was so proud of Russia's long revered tradition of puppetry. And the idea that we would make a Russian children's program and utilize these strange looking, unrealistic looking puppets from America, I mean, that was just unthinkable. And that ends up being one of the most interesting tug of wars that occurs in this whole project.
Yeah, no, it was almost, the Muppets were almost an international crisis. And eventually the puppets, you know, the Muppets that were created were extraordinary. They had like a puppet that was blue and is larger than Big Bird and kind of hound-like, and he's based on a Russian folklore, this character Domovoy, who is the spirit of the hearth and the home. And this is a character who lives in nature, so our Muppet lives inside a tree. But to get to this point where you know, was incredibly difficult, and the creative team at first wanted this character to be more similar to the character out of their own folklore, who's like an old man with flashing fiery eyes, and he generally, tells children how to behave. And that didn't seem, you know, seem ideal, considering a lot of the Muppets are very childlike and playful and curious to reflect how children relate to the world. But the first, very early on, the creative team invited the top puppet designer to meet with me and show me what puppets they thought should be in their Sesame Street show. So he walked in with two giant sacks. He pulled out two puppets that are like wood. So they're hard wood, and they have kind of cruel expressions on their face. And he raises his arms, and immediately one puppet starts to hit the other one and says, "I will kill you, I will kill you." And everybody in the room is laughing. And I'm just sitting here thinking, I don't know if this, like, puppet-on-puppet violence is very Sesame Street-like. So I was a little worried from that point. But there were also, as you say, big challenges with the music. And the music director initially wanted the show to have only classical music. She was, rightfully so, very proud of Russia's music tradition, which is world-renowned, and they've made some of the greatest contributions to the arts in the world, Russia has. And I understood where she was coming from, because most of the animated children's series use classical music. So her perspective wasn't unusual. But Sesame Street itself is known for its very, inventive and sounds, and the diversity of the music. The whole idea of making the show was to, introduce new elements into Russian culture, to widen people's understanding of what new Russia could be. And for me personally, it was an opportunity, since I had made an earlier film about underground rock and roll with rock musicians who had been persecuted under communism, who could not perform their music, who couldn't record their music under the state communist system, because there were studios, but they were owned by the state. So the state did not support the creation of rock music. They felt it was poisoning to communist culture, poisoning to children to listen to rock music. When I was the executive producer of Ulitsa Sazam, Sesame Street in Russia, I thought, wow, we could also give these people jobs. We could make this a place for these young musicians who didn't have opportunities under communism to write music. So there was a bit of a battle there. It was also a really incredible learning process for me in terms of how to effect change in Russia while still being culturally sensitive to the music director and everybody else.
That is just one of many important stories that are part of your amazing book, again titled Muppets in Moscow, The Unexpected, Crazy, True Story of Making Sesame Street in Russia, published by Roman and Littlefield, and the author, Natasha Lance Rogoff. Thank you so much for telling this remarkable story. We leave it to our listeners to explore more of the details of this extraordinary story, a story unfortunately laced with some tragedy, some violence, and of course at the heart of this story, the determination of you and others to make this program a reality. Natasha Lance Rogoff, again, your book Muppets in Moscow is so worth exploring. And I appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Very, very best wishes to you.
Thank you so much, Greg. I really had a good time. You asked great questions.
tomorrow on the morning show, a couple of different interviews, including one with Dr. Susan J. Noonan, the author of Reconnecting After Isolation, Coping with Anxiety, Depression,